you want to move to a world where you're telling people you want to go to electric, in addition, we want you to power that with renewable energy, you need a solution that bridges it. And battery swapping is the perfect bridge between renewable energy and mobility.
Recent studies have shown that the number one concern consumers have when thinking about buying an electric vehicle is not the price, it's not the range or how far the car will go. It's finding a charging station when you're on the road. But what if that was as easy, recharging your car, as it is to pop a battery out of a flashlight and put one right back in, if you could be in and out in 5 minutes? Today, we're going to speak with the person who is building that future right now. My name is Lex Kiefaber, and welcome back to Who's Saving the Planet. Joining us on today's show is John D'Souza, the president and co-founder of Ample. Simply put, Ample is creating the technology and the machines necessary to swap out electric vehicle batteries for cars instead of having to plug in and charge them, dramatically reducing the amount of time it takes to get a fresh charge and put you back on the road. Ample has raised over $290 million to build this technology and propel the transformation to an electric vehicle future even faster. But I wanted to start with this first question of how Ample is going to alleviate that number one anxiety that people have, which is finding a place to charge their car when they're on the road. Here's what he had to say.
I think it is the number one concern, but a lot of people don't realize it yet. I still hear a lot of people saying, oh, it's range anxiety. And what they don't realize is that if you have a gas car, nobody even thinks about range. And the reason is exactly for what you mentioned, is because filling up the gas tank is very simple and very quick. The issue we have with an electric car is what happens when you run out of charge, and it's charging anxiety, or how long is it going to be and how painful is it going to be. And it can be pretty painful, which is what people go through. And I'll take you just a couple minute detour. My brother had his electric car stolen a few weeks ago. And the police weren't interested in going after it. We could see where the car was. So we jumped in a car and started following it. Eventually, the person's charge drops below 10%. And they pull into a charger. And they're waiting in line. After about 35 minutes, they bail on the car, leave, and we go and pick it up. and we joke that you can't even steal a car with charging.
But I mean, of all the things that you've done in your life, I did not see like vigilante as like part of the resume where you're hopping in a car and saying, here I am, the persecutor of justice.
I know, exactly. Here I'm chasing you. I'm on hot on your tail.
This is a good point, right? When we think about how things work very broadly, batteries have been something that we as humans have used for many decades, up to a century. And we think about popping them out and putting in a new one. It's an exchange of something. A new technology was to charge the battery. That is something that is relatively recent in terms of our ability to adjust our relationship with these technologies at scale. You guys are doing it the opposite way, where electric vehicles, now what we think of is charging them. And you are saying we have a better way. We have a new opportunity to do the same thing, which is to give you power, but to do that in a more expedient fashion and potentially as a cheaper fashion. But it is incredibly complicated, I have to imagine.
Well, you said it, what got us interested in battery swapping, and battery swapping in electric vehicles were very popular. If you go back in the 30s and 40s, lots of electric vehicles, and they actually had great fleets doing charging, and a lot of them moved over to battery swapping at that time. What ended up happening is gas worked really well. And the reason gas works really well is you stop and you physically move the energy into the car. You don't stop at a gas station and wait them for do some chemical conversion of it and do gas and drive away. That would never work. And so the problem with electric vehicles is that you're trying to do that. You're trying to go and take electricity and convert it to chemical bonds. It's a very exothermic reaction, and you're trying to do it very quickly, which is what's very tough. And so we said, we should just do what we do with gas, is do that separately, do it slowly, carefully, efficiently, and then let's very quickly move it into the car. The beauty of that is that suppose you double the capacity of the vehicle, if you charge it, you need twice as much time. If you physically move it in, you can do it in the same amount of time. Mm-hmm. And that really helps you, because a lot of people are moving to different capacity batteries. And if you start thinking about trucks or semis, you don't want to take 10 times longer to charge it. You want to be doing it very efficiently. And so that's what we got to move it physically into a car, and that solves a major problem. Now, the question that people have is, why didn't this happen before? So if people did swapping before, the issue that you have is that all the solutions people came up with is exactly what you think of. I put a swap to battery. Let me take out this big battery and put another big battery in. But that gives you a solution that's very specific to that vehicle. It will work on that vehicle. You can't use it with other vehicles. It also is expensive. You're moving a very heavy battery. It could be £1,000. And so when we looked at it, we said there are three solutions you need to solve if you actually want this to work. The first is it has to work with different types of vehicles. It has to work with cars and trucks. It can't be a different solution for each type. It has to work across automakers. You can't have one for one maker, one for next. And they all use different batteries. So that means you need to figure out how you can use batteries across different vehicles. And the last is you need the ability to roll out infrastructure quickly and cheaply if you have a chance of getting this to be adopted. So he said, if you solve those three, then you can do it.
When you lay that out there, it's like, well, yes, of course. But each one of those individual problems is a potentially crippling challenge to overcome. You're dealing with a many-to-one solution, many automakers, many different parts to adopting one piece of technology or one sort of means of doing something, whether it's yours or whether it's a standardized piece. Right now, there is none. So, of course, they'll need to be adopting something. You're dealing with a technological problem that is very complex in its own right. How do you take a very heavy thing, move it into a different, very specific spot without damaging anything in the process? So that's always hard to do to begin with, not to mention the materials themselves are, well, they're batteries. They're things that you want to make sure that you're treating very carefully. And the third part is that in order for this to work, it kind of needs to work everywhere, right? Like for it to be a solution, it has network effects in that true sense of the word, where the more adoption, the more utility it has, which means it's really, really hard to climb up that hill. So you're there in the boardroom, right? And this is 9 years ago, and you're like, here's this thing. We have these three set challenges to overcome. Where did you start?
Pretty universally, people told us we are crazy.
But like no billion-dollar business starts without somebody. If they say, this sounds pretty reasonable, it's like, this is never going to work. On the wrong track.
Yeah. And it was funny because we talked to so many, everybody goes, oh my God, this is, and especially because we were just after we had a company you tried it, didn't work out, and people would say, this is never, it sounds like, you know, pigs flying out. It's not going to, but for us, when we looked at it, and we looked at the full case of what people say, a lot of people told us that within 2 to 3 years, you'll have these super fast chargers all around that will charge a car in right. 5 minutes. And when we actually dove into that, we just did not see it as being possible. We don't have the grid support it. It's too energy inefficient. It's too costly. And so we went through it and said, it's not going to work. And I always believe that, you know, when there are a lot of people and people tell you you're crazy, sorry, you need to say back, maybe you are crazy. So we did the work and did it. And I said, we don't think we're crazy on this. So we dove into it. I think with each of these, the first step was exactly what you did. We said, let's just work on our own. Let's go through and see whether this is possible. And I think we had a few big breakthroughs. The first was modularity. Was the way to get this to work across different vehicles is to deal with a small battery. You can't deal with a big battery that immediately imposes a standardization on the vehicles. So we said, let's go with small batteries that we fit into vehicles. So we actually adapt to the vehicle rather than asking the vehicle to adapt to us. Mm-hmm. That was the first big breakthrough. The goal was to say, we want to work with the vehicle without requiring any changes from the auto manufacturer. And modularity allowed us to achieve that.
How would you achieve scale then if you are picking one manufacturer as your baseline to work with? So you have a many-to-many problem, right? Like if you, in order for this to work, it needs to work across many different types of car companies, many different cars. And so if you're being specific in the first use case, is that replicable or is that something that you would, we'll figure out that challenge down the road?
Actually, what we did is we went with a very small size battery. Mm-hmm. So that in a car, you might have 14 or even 20 of them. And it allows us to fit like Lego pieces into any car from any manufacturer. So it solves the physical problem of how do you physically fit into a vehicle without requiring any changes. There's a second part of that problem, which is the chemistries are different, but I'll get to that in a second. So the first one is, let's go with a small battery and we will adapt to it. Whether it's a truck, whether it's a small car, we'll be able to figure out how to adapt our small batteries and fit it in like Lego pieces to go into a car. Mm-hmm. the second part that which you're alluding to is every car has a different chemistry.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so you take your batteries, go there, you may fill it in, but it won't work efficiently because the chemistry is different. The second part was very tricky. We came up with smart batteries to effectively be able to go through and separate the car from the chemistry. So we can actually use software control power electronics in the battery to match exactly what the car expects. That was another very important one. This allows us to put the batteries in and they go, okay, I'm in this car. I know what they expect electrically. Let me go and adjust for it. You put it into a different car, it does exactly the same thing. So the combination of those two allow you to fit the batteries into any size vehicle. It could be small versus big. And then the separation of battery and vehicle and chemistry allows you to go through and adjust it. So with those two, you can actually have the batteries work in any car, any shape of car, and have it work efficiently.
How long did it take for you to get to that place where you could prove that out?
So it was a few years. And I'd probably say if you think about the first 4 to 5 years, it was a lot of technology development out there. And we need to see, can we do it? Can we do it effectively? Can we prove it out? And it's kind of magical. We were able at early stage to have a Nissan Leaf drive, for say, on batteries that we had developed. And actually the first car drove on radio control batteries. This is your RC car batteries. Now, you wouldn't drive it very far on this, but the ability to be able to go through and take a car and have it drive on these batteries using all this power electronics was incredibly powerful. It shows that this is possible. And the second side was, how do you go through and do this cost effectively? And so we went in and we developed from scratch the swapping stations because we wanted, we realized that a lot of the costs of installing equipment is construction. So we needed to build a full system that required no construction. You're not digging into ground at all. That decreases the cost. And then we built everything, all the robotics, everything from ground up so that we could keep the costs down. So the combination of that gives us a station that we can deploy in 3 days. You give us a couple of parking spots, give us 3 days and we're up and running. And then we can go and have your vehicle come in, 5 minutes, batteries are swapped and drives out.
So many of the technologies that we think of that are going to be transformative to combat this larger issue that we have vis-a-vis the existential crisis that is humans on Earth, this requires so much money, not only ingenuity, not only thoughtfulness, not only luck, brilliance, all of those things, but you need to go out to the world and say, give me money now and I will give you more money later. And there are, as you just mentioned, not only a tremendous number of very complex challenges, but also things that are outside of your control. Car manufacturers, parallel technologies that are being developed, the entire infrastructure and the grid in order to be able to support these types of things. But necessarily, in order for this to make it work, you need to invest this half decade of R&D and testing and modular and to be able to grow this. How were you able to make that compelling argument when the returns would be so far in the future, potential gains would be huge, but in order to get there would require, and I'm sure at the beginning you said this, we'll have milestones along the way, but before you're actually getting a return on this investment, a tremendous mountain needs be ascended.
Yeah, I have to say the fundraising initially was exceedingly painful, and it was actually maybe over 150 funds that turned us down as we went through. What we realized as we went through the process was that we needed to find people who understood the space. Okay. This wasn't a good fit for generalist funds. If it's a generalist fund, often you'd get one of the partners that come over and says, look, I drive a Tesla and it works perfectly. And they didn't see the issue because the Tesla was one of four cars they had. Okay. Often, you joke and go, what do you do when you do a long drive? And they go, oh, I just take the Porsche or I take the Maserati and it works perfectly. So in a way, they were disconnected from the real problem that people had, which is, look, I have one car and I need it to work. That wasn't the issue. So we went in and I think when we switched to focus and said, we need to work with people who understand two problems. One is the mobility problem. The other is the energy problem. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found the sweet spot where what really helped is they had gone through and looked at charging. They had gone through and looked at potential investing and they understood the issues. And when you spoke with them, they could realize that what we had built actually addressed those issues. And I think that was when we made the breakthrough.
You don't need to spend much time convincing me that the average venture capitalist is relatively disassociated from modern everyday life, but that is a personal aspect, not one that I'm extrapolating onto you. And to all of my venture capitalist friends out there, it's not you of whom I speak. But you still have to make that pitch, right? You still have to go in and be like, there's a financial outcome that is going to be profitable. And I say this because I think that this is an important question for everyone out there that's thinking of an idea that is wildly ambitious, right? And that needs to walk into this room with a degree of delusion to say, yeah, I understand this is going to be almost impossible, but it's not impossible. Yeah. And I'm the person to make that work. And so what's your advice?
One is, I think, just the mindset of somebody doing this. Because and me and my co-founder, Harlan, we've worked together for 17 years. And I think we align really well is we're not, you know, we live in the world of possible, but highly improbable. Mm-hmm. That's our world. You know, if it's probable, that's not our space. And you need to be, all you need is to see a path. That's it. And if you do, that gets us very excited and go, that's great. That's our space. You know, there's a million hurdles. And there are, you know, often people I meet go, well, you know, what's your biggest challenge? Well, there are 1,000 challenges every day and they change every day. The goal is every morning to say, which is the biggest one right now and go through and tackle it. So I think you need that mindset to survive it. The other one, in terms of making the pitch out there, I think that's find the people that go through and understand it, but also putting yourself in their mindset. You're exactly right. They're looking and saying, how do I go through and get risk-adjusted return here? And if they come in and they say that this is a high risk, they better look at a high return. So you have to look at it from that approach. And the approach we took it at and said is, if you look at the full auto and energy industry, if you look at the top companies in the world, the energy companies, you know, I think in some ways the auto companies have done a really tough job by making millions of vehicles that people drive for 10, 20 years out there, and they work really well. But if you look at where a lot of the profit has gone, it's gone to the energy companies. And so our pitch was them is that there is a very big problem. There's a massive transition going on in the energy space. And there's an opportunity for new players in the world to join those others and to be there. And we explained how we solve not just the mobility problem, but the energy problem. So mobility we spoke about. The energy problems, we're moving to renewable energy. Renewable energy, you know, the sun shines part of the day, the wind blows when it wants. And you're moving that to drive mobility where cars show up randomly on your grid and draw down tremendous power. Marrying that is exceedingly difficult. And we said, if you want to move to a world where you're telling people we want to go to electric, in addition, we want you to power that with renewable energy, you need a solution that bridges it. And battery swapping is the perfect bridge between renewable energy and mobility, and give them the ability to say that, how could this be one of the next energy companies out there?
So then let's play this forward. Let's play this forward in two ways. Show me the world in 5 or 10 years when you have achieved the wildest success that you can imagine. Paint that picture. And then afterwards, tell me what happened in 5 years when this company failed spectacularly. So let's start with the first one. What does that first world look like where this technology is being adopted ubiquitously, or whatever frame that you put to say this is our biggest possible success?
We do a couple of things in that world. We're going through and we're providing stations everywhere that provide people with 5-minute swaps. It's exactly like the gas stations you're used to. You stop by anywhere, regardless of what type of vehicle, and you can get energy very quickly. In addition, those batteries and stations provide you with the renewable energy storage. So you're actually powering this by renewable energy with solar and wind or hydrogen. So you're creating the perfect bridge. And as the world transitions, this can actually feed energy back into the grid as well. And over time, ease that transition. So it solves both those worlds. And that's the world we look forward. That's what we want to do. We want to help transition that from both the people in mobility and the people in pushing renewables.
Do you see this then working in tandem with the traditional charging stations, or is traditional charging obsolete and battery swapping the dominant monopoly form of energy for electric vehicles?
Yeah, I think there are great places for example, if you just charge your car in your house, that's a great use case.
Right.
You know, why would you swap? So I think there are cases in which charging works really well, and they'll continue to add. There'll be other use cases where I don't think it works and this will go. So I think there's a world in which they both live in together.
So that was the fun one. Now the other one. What keeps you up at night? That you're like, if this is our biggest existential fear.
You know, what worries me is you go through and one is you see people changing their climate goals. They put aggressive climate goals and then they come back and they push it out even further. And you're seeing that with some of the energy companies pushing it out. We've seen that with a lot of the fleet companies. They come out and they say we're going to go 100% electric and then they want maybe not. So I think is it, do we have the will to go through and do it? Are we going to say, look, short-term profit is worth more if you don't make any transition, we'll make more money and sort of just not do it. I think that's going to be a country by country. I think some countries have really made that commitment to go through. And I think also if you look at, for example, the subsidies on fossil fuels, I'm going to get it wrong, but the annual subsidies for fossil fuel is some crazy amount globally. It's on the order of over $1 trillion.
Yeah, I was just saying, in the United States, I think it's over $480 billion recently here, and that's just in the US.
So, on the other hand, the subsidies for EVs are a tiny fraction of that when you go through. And you see, for example, I think it was in Texas right now where they've just gone through and instituted their $400 fee on all EVs. So do we have it, or are we sort of in a way incentivized to keep the old world going because the people making money on that don't want to change? So I think that's that. If we want to do it, we can do it. The question is, you know, do we really want to do it?
This just reminds me of one of my new favorite quotes, which is, we have met the enemy and they are us. In the sense that we are staring down as a people.
Yes.
We are indeed. We will be the agent of our own demise, but also the only potential for our salvation. So what a wonderful time to be alive. You bring up a couple of things that I want to talk about in terms of the relationship that is necessary between government entities, infrastructure entities, traditional energy companies, large manufacturers. But before that, you guys have achieved tremendous success, right? Raised hundreds of millions of dollars. You have partnerships now internationally rolling out this technology. But I know, because everyone does, there were moments along this path where you had to face some sort of existential decision or crisis where the business was on the line. And I just find it both compelling and frankly comforting to talk to people who have crossed that Rubicon about what it was like in those moments. What did you experience and how did you make your way through?
And I'll be honest, as a startup, there's still, you know, there have been, they continue to be, and there will be a lot more of those moments.
Right. You know, the work continues. Exactly. No rest for the wicked.
It's never done. The challenges keep on changing. The thing about initially some of the challenges with, is this even possible? So how do you go through? So yeah, the types of challenges have changed, but the challenges continue, and there's still a lot of challenges through that. And it takes a lot of work. For example, some of the subsidies that you're doing were very specific to, you need to have a certain type of charger installed, you know, a certain standard. And you wait. And so we do a lot of work, and luckily the governments were receptive to say, it should be technology agnostic. You can move energy into a vehicle. How you get there should be irrelevant. So there are different types of challenges in terms of going there. But there are a lot of moments across where you sit there and go, it is tough. It could be initially getting the funding. It was a really tough, and initially Hal and I were going through and funding it. And you sit there and go, will we ever persuade somebody to start funding this? It wasn't clear. Then you go through and does it and start. Once you get the first vehicle moving was a big point. Getting the first OEM was a massive one. Uh-huh. I'd say that, you know, the fleets were a better one because the fleets had already experienced the trouble. They knew what it was like. So I think the fleets was initially easier than we thought. We went there and go, yep, we can tell you the list of issues we have. So that was pleasantly surprising. And then working with the governments in terms of getting them to understand why this is important, why should they actually make things technology agnostic, was tough. And that changed. We received a couple of 15 million from the CEC, 10 million euros from the European Union, where we've gone through and now they're getting there. So there are new challenges that we're fighting about, but we definitely went through a lot of those moments of, this is a big hurdle and we've been at it for a while and it's still there.
Your tranquility in discussing this, I feel like probably belies quite a bit of anguish living through those moments. I want to touch on something that you said before, which is in order for us to solve or even sort of begin to live in the world that climate change is presenting us, we'll take a multidisciplinary approach in terms of private enterprise, government work, technology, public adoption of technology, all of these things. What we've seen for the last five decades is a fantastic appetite for traditional fossil fuel energy companies to leverage that system as much as possible. And they are fantastically good at it, ruthlessly effective. There's a few companies that are challenging that way of doing business, of taking fossil fuels out of the ground and using those as energy. I'm always curious as to the appetite to also meet those challenges in places like the halls of government, where the entrenched powers are very, very good at stacking the deck in their favor. And it's our job, and specifically your job, to start to balance that out, to start to influence those people that are making those types of decisions, in theory, on behalf of their constituents. But they require leverage and they require influence. So how do you think of that in terms of whether it is critical to your business outcomes, whether it's a moral responsibility as one of the leaders of a renewable energy company, whether it simply is something that is going to be tactically to your advantage? Sort of where do you see that playing into your day-to-day in the Ample's future?
Well, as you've seen an example, people often say about 40% of the charges often in the US are not working at any given time. You know, why is that? You know, why do we have such bad uptime? And then you start digging into it and realize that a lot of the incentives are for people to install chargers. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening, you install that, people want to cheat, they're going to get a certain incentive. You build those in cheapest places, not necessarily where they're needed. You get paid for installing it, and then you move on. You're not paid to keep it up and running. And so with the policies and goals, we're going to have dramatic impacts on what happened. And so it's really important to go back and say, how do you actually incentivize the right things? So what we do is we spend a lot of time saying, and we have a great person on our team, Levi, going through and working on it in terms of saying, how do you actually go through and do good policy? And often if you can think about good policy, it should have the impact you want at the end. Like if you want to get people to transition, you should give them a subsidy based on how much it's used, how much actually a decarbonization achieves. And so a lot of what we do there is stay step back and saying, what are you going to go and do? And are the policies furthering that? And fortunately, we found that people are very receptive, but it does take time. You have to invest the time to do the education, to go and meet with all the right people. Because if you don't, policy keeps on moving ahead and you find yourself shut out, and then trying to work back from a deep hole is really tough. And we had some tough moments. We had actually a briefing involved. We invited a bunch of people to go learn about it, and it got canceled pretty close to it. And we found out that there was a lobbyist that was incentivized differently, that really put pressure to have it canceled. And so you're fighting those and you go, wait, what happened? And they said, oh, okay. So people are spending a lot of money. There are a lot of people that are happy with the status quo, don't want to see a change. And so you're fighting not just the new policies come out, but the entrenched ones where they really don't want you to change anything in the process.
Do you think it's important for companies that are challenging that orthodoxy to unite around a shared vision and to start applying some counterbalance to that, some influence of their own?
I think it is very important. And I think going with a broad perspective is much better. So example, for us, we join the charging companies to go through and push it. In the end, for any of us to succeed, we need to help move the policy in that direction. So I think what really serves people well right now is to form these broad coalitions with lots of different types of policies, thinking, then moves in the right direction, and then go through and figure out how to get each of those business models to work. But I think if people who are early in that transition start getting very specific. You'll never achieve to fight the entrenched policy. So I think it's a great idea. I think getting these broad coalitions to work together is a great idea.
So I have the distinct benefit of not leading a billion-dollar company, which allows me to be very much, very less political when thinking and speaking about these things. And I think there's just an appetite for a much more pugnacious attitude in terms of this, where you see on the other side, there's no, not only is there no reluctance to employ whatever tactics will achieve the goal, but there's also no shame involved with it. It just seems like, yeah, of course, we are going to fight for ours, whatever that is. And I speak to a lot of people that are on the other side trying to fight for things that are more existential in terms of like the future of humanity. And there is this, well, we need to be measured. We need to be considerate. We need to be coalition builders as opposed to going in. And it's like, yeah, but like we have a limited amount of time to have a fantastic amount of change. We've tried the reasonable path. Is there not also room for the unreasonable one?
You know, I think where you need to go with this is, as you work with all of the governments, I think sometimes you end up with policies that are not completely thought through. I think that leads you in very...
That's generous of you, John. That is a very generous way of approximating government, yes.
But you end up in these precarious situations, and I'll give you an example. So sometimes you get these policies, it sounds good at a high level. They go, let's just move all the ride sharing over to electric. And that sounds, at a high level, you say, yeah, great, that's a great idea. But if you don't follow that up with looking at, is the infrastructure available? Are the cars available? What are going to happen? What ends up happening is that the drivers take the brunt of that burden. I think the estimate is only about 1% of ride-sharing drivers have access to an at-home charger. So you force them to go on. They end up spending 10 to 12 hours a week at a charger charging. So what has happened is you've taken their quality of life, made it much worse. The income they make is dropped because they're not earning money when they do it. And so I think sometimes policies can be made in the absence of the reality because people are disconnected from the reality of people doing it, and it doesn't serve people well, and it penalizes certain groups disproportionately. So I think it is, we need to do it, but it has to, and I'm really scared about people who aren't disconnected from the day-to-day person saying, oh, let's just push this policy through. There are no charges, there are no vehicles, but you have to do it. It works well if you can afford a really expensive vehicle and charge it at home, but for everybody else, it falls apart.
I'll stop badgering you about this thing because clearly it's my own personal grit, but I appreciate you playing my game with that. But the last question that I want to ask is one that's very topical. We are seeing the rollout of autonomous vehicles now in your hometown of San Francisco. I'm in DC. I've just passed a fleet of them. It's about to be rolled out soon. Obviously, this is going to have systemic changes on transportation writ large. How do you see that fitting into something that you specifically just mentioned, right? When these cars are not something that are owned and operated by individual drivers, but will either be their uptime as transportation options will be, 23 hours a day. How do you see that fitting in with your idea of powering these vehicles through your technology?
I think there are two aspects to that. One, I think, is that from an autonomous electric it makes sense for autonomous. It's a great place to go. It's rolled out. You don't want to take a bunch of gas cars and make them autonomous. Autonomous electric cars works perfectly with battery swapping. These are cars that you want to get them to do high utilization to amortize the capital expense of the vehicle. They can go in wherever they want, get a 5-minute swap, stay on the roads, and it works well. And I think so. When you think about renewable energy, electric, and autonomous, it's hard to think of a better fit. They go through really, really well. And so for us, I think that's probably the perfect use case for it. But I will just say one thing about autonomous is that I think, going back to what you said as well, from a policy perspective, we have an abnormally low tolerance for any sort of mistakes on autonomous. I don't think it's going to fit as well. You have a vehicle that has a slight issue. There's a fire truck, I think, that hit one of the autonomous vehicles in San Francisco, and the immediate reaction is, oh, we should just pull them all off the streets. And I think it's hard for us as a society to take a step back and say, we have over 3,000 people a year that die every year from car accidents. But if we hold the standard to autonomous being that one person is injured and we should pull them off, we're never going to make progress. So I think that's what we really need to do, an education campaign. We need to look to what the ultimate goal is, to bring those deaths down. And this is a great technology. And if we approach it the way we do right now, it'll be very slow progress. And similar to, I think, the full energy, there are a lot of people that are not incentivized to moving to autonomous. So people are going to fight it all the way. But I think at a higher perspective, we can save those many lives, we can make the transition, it would be really good. So I think it goes back also to policy perspective. We need to look at what we're achieving, and we can't come up with unrealistic goals that unfairly just penalize one group.
Last question. This is a question that I ask Gabriel. If you could go back in time and speak to the version of you 9 years ago, when you were 9.5 years ago, when you were just starting this, what advice would you give that version of John?
You know, I think there are two. One is whether it's possible, and it's great to say it is possible. But I think the other was the surprise thing is when we worked a lot with the auto manufacturers, and going through, we went in initially being really scared of them. Everybody we told us that they have a lot of examples of companies they found on this that worked with auto manufacturers and it didn't work out. So people really, really scared us about that. I actually think in going back, the issue is auto manufacturers do something very tough. They have to get a vehicle out there. This vehicle works for a very long time. It has to be reliable. It has to be safe. And so for them, changes are very difficult. So that is, I think, a really important, it sounds simple, but it's a very important lesson, which took us a while to get to. It's not that they're hard to work with. It's hard for them to make changes in a process that has to run like clockwork. And that realization really was profound for us. Because if you can limit that change, they're happy to work with you. It's just that when you ask them to make a change in a process that's running and producing millions of vehicles, it is extremely hard. So I think for us, when we change our mindset to appreciating what they did, it sort of, I think for us, that was a pivotal moment in working with them to say, okay, now we understand the challenges. When we go to them and say, look, we're not asking for all these changes, it made it much easier. So I think that was one, it took us a while to get there. And I think a lot of the lessons that people told us, people gave us sort of a lot of horror stories about them trying to work with our manufacturers, companies going bankrupt, and they're really scared us. And I think that understanding that upfront would have really helped us, you know, very started.
Know your customer. But at the end of the day, every business comes back to you. If you can understand what pains your customer, you'll be in a better position to be successful. Well, John, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us your perspective. Congratulations on the tremendous success. And I look forward to following along as you continue to, you don't use this word lightly, but disrupt the world of electric vehicles.
No, thank you. And I would end with one thing, you know, with all the listeners and all that, I think we do have an important say in this transition. Okay. I feel a lot of people think as if it's way beyond them. But I think if we want to make this transition to a world that has a lot more decarbonization, all of our small choices do matter. And so I would just push everybody out there. I think as a country, we have an abnormally high carbon footprint per person. Not as a country, per person, very, very high. And I think that's where each one of us can actually do our part to decrease that. And it will have an impact. And I just came back from Japan, and it's interesting when they had the Fukushima disaster, they decided as a country, they want to shut down nuclear reactors, but that would require people to help them with that. And as soon as they said that, people changed the temperature they maintain things at. So if you often go into offices, houses, stores, it's actually slightly warmer. Why are they so? The reason they did that is I think they did that and they decreased energy consumption. And I'll get the number wrong, but I think by like 10%. Where individual choices can have a very large impact. And if I leave people that, I'd say that, look, don't think that this is on a larger scale. It's actually on a micro scale as well. And I think all of us can do our part to accelerating it.
Okay. We share the planet. And so we all have some responsibility to it. Absolutely. Okay, John. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate your time here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Who's Saving the Planet. We'll be back next week with another story of someone working to build a more sustainable future. My name is Lex Kiefhaber. Take care.